Harper Paperbacks and Harper Audio present The Couple at Number 9, a novel by Claire Douglas, read by Natalie Buscombe
and Kenton Thomas.
Part 1. Chapter 1. Safi, April 2018. I'm in the front garden, pulling at weeds that spill out from the borders of the driveway, like gigantic spiders, when I hear yells, deep and guttural. The builders are in the rear garden with a mechanical digger. All morning, as I was pruning the rosebush under the living room window, I could hear the thrum of it on the breeze, like a nagging headache. But now it's stopped. It's enough to make my heart pound, and Snowy, Gran's little Westie, who's lying beside me, prick up his ears. I turn towards the cottage, a film of sweat breaking out between my shoulder blades. Has something happened? I imagine severed joints and gushing blood, at odds with the blue skies and the dazzling sunshine. And my stomach heaves. I've never had a strong gut at the best of times, but being 14 weeks pregnant, I'm still experiencing morning sickness. Well, morning, noon, and night sickness. I stand up, mud stains on the knees of my jeans, still my usual size, although the waistband is snugger. I deliberate, chewing the inside of my cheek, inwardly berating myself for being so indecisive. Snowy stands up too, his ears pricked, and he emits one solitary bark as a builder, Jonty, the young good-looking one, suddenly appears from around the side of the house. He's running towards me, damp circles under the armpits of his t-shirt, as he waves his cap in the air to get my attention, his sandy curls bouncing with each step. Shit. He's going to tell me there's been an accident. I fight the urge to run in the opposite direction, instead shielding my eyes from the sun that beats down onto the thatched roof. Jonty doesn't appear injured, but as he gets closer, I can see shock on his freckled face.
Is someone hurt?
I call, trying to keep the panic out of my voice. Oh, God, I'm going to have to ring for an ambulance. I've never phoned 999 in my life, and I'm not good with blood. I wanted to be a nurse when I was younger, until I fainted when my best friend fell off her bike and gashed her knee open.
No, sorry to disturb you, but...
He sounds out of breath, and his words tumble out in a rush.
We found something. You better come, quick.
I drop my gardening gloves onto the grass and follow him around the side of the cottage, Snowy at my heels, wondering what it could be. Treasure, perhaps? Some relic from the past that could be exhibited in a museum? But the yells, they weren't of joy at the discovery of something precious. They were laced with fear. I wish Tom was here. I don't feel comfortable dealing with the builders while he's at work. They constantly ask questions, expecting me to make decisions I'm worried will be wrong, and I've never been very authoritarian. At 24, Tom and I are only 3 years out of university. All of this, the move from the flat in Croydon to Beggar's Nook, a quaint village in the Cotswolds, and the cottage with views of the woods, has been so unexpected, a surprise gift. Jonty leads me to the back garden. Before the builders came, it had looked idyllic with the mature shrubbery, the honeysuckle snaked around the trellises, and the rockery in the corner filled with velvety pansies in a burst of pinks and lilacs. Now, there is an ugly orange digger surrounded by a huge mound of unearthed soil. The other two builders, Darren, mid-30s with a hipster beard, who, by his confident stance, is the boss, and Carl, around my age and as stocky as a rugby player, stare down at the hole they've made in the ground, hands on hips, their heavy boots sinking into the soil. They whip their heads up in perfect synchrony when I approach. They're wearing matching shocked expressions, but Carl's eyes are flashing with something akin to excitement. I follow his gaze and notice a glint of ivory among the soil, protruding like broken china. Instinctively, I reach down and grab hold of Snowy's collar to prevent him from darting into the hole.
While we were digging, we found something, says Darren, folding his arms across his dirt-streaked t-shirt.
What is it? Snowy strains against my hand, and I tighten my grip.
Remains.
Darren's expression is grim.
Like an animal? I ask.
Darren and the others exchange a look. Carl steps forward confidently, almost gleefully, kicking up dust from the ground as he does so.
It looks like a hand.
I step back in horror. So you're saying they're human?
Darren regards me with sympathy. I think so. You better call the police.
Chapter 2. By the time Tom arrives home 2 hours later, I'm pacing our tiny kitchen. It looks like a relic from the 1980s with its farmhouse units and the scenes of fat-cheeked pigs and sheep on the wall tiles. We've managed to squeeze in our oak table from the flat, although we can pull out only 2 of the 4 chairs. Not long after we moved in February, we'd sat with the architect, a short, balding man in his 60s called Clive, with a good local reputation, planning the back of the house. The kitchen would be extended and span the width of the cottage, with crittle doors leading out into the large garden. And to be honest, it's taken my mind off my pregnancy, which I still feel jittery about, even though I've had the 12-week scan and everything looks okay. But I'm blighted with what-ifs. What if I miscarry the baby? What if it doesn't grow properly, or comes too early, or I have a stillbirth? What if I can't cope when the baby is born, or will suffer postnatal depression? The pregnancy hadn't been planned. It was something Tom and I had spoken about, loosely, after perhaps a wedding. But we'd been busy starting up our respective career ladders and saving for a deposit to buy our own flat. Babies and weddings had been for when we were older, for when we became proper grown-ups. But I'd been ill with a stomach bug, had forgotten to take extra precautions, and that one slip-up had resulted in this. A baby. I'd be a young mother, but not as young as my own mum had been. Snowy is stretched out in his bed by the oven, head on his paws, watching me as I pace. From the leaded window, I can see the hub of activity in the back garden. A white tent has been erected over half of the lawn, and police officers and men in forensic suits come and go, along with another officer, a camera slung around his neck. Fluorescent yellow tape has been put up around the tent, and it flaps in the slight breeze. It has "Crime Scene, Do Not Cross" printed along its length, and it makes me feel nauseous every time it catches my eye. It might look like a scene from an ITV crime drama, but its presence drives home the reality of the situation. I'd been surprised, and actually a little bit proud, of myself for how quickly I'd taken control of things after I'd recovered from the shock. First, calling the police, and then, after we'd given our statements, sending the builders home, saying I'd let them know when they could resume work, even if my heart still pounded the whole time. Then I'd called Tom at his office in London. He'd said he'd be on the next train home. I hear Tom's Lambretta pull up on the driveway. He's always wanted one, and treated himself to the second-hand moped when we moved here to get back and forth to the station. It's cheaper than running 2 cars, and all the spare money we had saved is going on this extension. I hear the front door slam. Tom rushes into the kitchen, concern etched all over his face. He has his glasses on, the trendy black-rimmed pair he bought when he started his new job in the finance department of a tech company over a year ago. He felt they gave him more gravitas. His sandy blonde fringe falls over his face, and he's rumpled in his linen shirt and blazer over jeans. It doesn't matter what he wears, he still manages to look like a student. He smells of London, of fumes and trains and takeaway lattes and other people's expensive scents. Snowy is circling our legs, and Tom bends down to pat him distractedly. But his attention is firmly on me.
Oh my God, are you okay? What a shock. The baby, he says, straightening up.
It's all fine. We're fine, I say, palms on my stomach protectively. The police are still outside. They've interviewed me and the builders, and now they've set up crime tape and a tent and everything. Fuck. He looks past me at the scene from the window, and his expression darkens for a few seconds. Then he turns to me.
Have they given you much info?
Not much, no. It's a human skeleton. Who knows how long it's been there? It could date back a few hundred years, for all I know.
Or to Roman times, he says, smiling wryly.
Exactly. Probably been here before Skeleton Place was even built. And that was... I frown, realizing I can't actually remember.
1855.
Of course Tom would know. He only has to read things once to remember them. He's always the first to answer a general knowledge question on game shows, and he's forever looking up facts and trivia on his phone. He's the opposite to me. Calm, pragmatic, and never overreacts.
It looks like serious shit, though,
muses Tom, his eyes still fixed on the scene in the garden. I follow his gaze. Someone has turned up with two cadaver dogs. Do they suspect more bodies? My stomach twists. Tom turns back to me, his voice serious.
Not what we expected when we moved to the country.
A beat of silence before we break into nervous laughter. Oh, God, I say, sobering up. It feels wrong to laugh. Somebody died after all.
This sets us off again.
We are interrupted by the clearing of a throat, and we turn to see a uniformed policewoman standing at the back door. It's one of those stable-style ones, so the top part is open, and it frames her, like she's about to perform a puppet show. She's regarding us as if we're a couple of naughty school kids. Snowy starts barking at her.
It's okay,
murmurs Tom to Snowy. Sorry to interrupt, says the officer, not looking sorry at all. I did knock. She pushes open the bottom half of the door so that she's standing on the threshold.
That's fine, says Tom.
He releases Snowy, who instantly darts over to the police officer to sniff her trousers. She looks vaguely irritated while gently pushing him away with her leg. PC Amanda Price. She's older than us by about 15 years, with a dark bob and intense blue eyes. Can I just confirm you are the owners of this property? Tom Perkins and Saffron Cutler? Technically, my mother is, but I don't complicate things by saying so.
Yes, says Tom, widening his eyes at me. This is our cottage.
Right, says PC Price. We'll be a bit longer, I'm afraid. Is there someone you can stay with tonight? Maybe for the weekend? I think of Tara, who currently lives in London, and my school friend Beth, who's in Kent. Tom's friends are either in Poole, where he's originally from, or Croydon. We haven't lived here long. We haven't made friends in the area yet, I say, and it brings home how isolated we are in this new village in the middle of nowhere. Parents nearby? Tom shakes his head. Mine still live in Poole, and Safi's mum's in Spain. And my dad lives in London, I say. But he's only got a one-bedroom flat. She frowns, like this is all information she doesn't need. Then may I suggest a hotel, just until Sunday? The police will pay your expenses for this inconvenience. It's just while the crime scene is being secured and the excavation is completed. The words crime scene and excavation make me feel sick. When can the building work resume? Tom asks. She sighs, as though this is a question too far. I'm afraid you won't be able to use the back garden until the excavation and removal of the skeleton has been completed. You'll have to wait until you hear from the SOCO, a scenes of crime officer, she clarifies when we look at her with puzzled expressions. So you think this is a crime? I ask, throwing Tom a concerned look. He tries to smile at me in reassurance, but it's more of a grimace. We're treating it as a crime scene, yes, she says, as though I'm incredibly stupid. But she doesn't offer any further information, and I sense it would be fruitless to ask. We've only been here a few months, I say, feeling the need to explain, just in case this stern police officer thinks we might have had something to do with it, like we're in the habit of hiding dead bodies in our garden. It might have been here years, centuries perhaps. But the look on her face makes me falter. PC Price purses her lips together. I'm not at liberty to say anything further for now. The CSI have requested a forensic anthropologist to confirm the bones are human, and we will keep you updated. I think of the hand that Carl claims he saw. It doesn't sound like there's much doubt. There follow a few beats of awkward silence before she goes to leave. Then she pauses, as though suddenly remembering. Oh, and please can you be out of here within the hour? We watch her step out into the back garden, into that gruesome world of police forensics, and I fight back tears. Tom reaches for my hand silently, as though he's lost the ability to offer words of comfort. And it suddenly hits me that this is really happening. Our dream home, our beautiful cottage, is now a crime scene. Luckily, the stag and pheasant in the village has a room for us to stay in, and they allow dogs. We turn up with one overnight bag each, which Tom insists on carrying while I take Snowy on his lead. The landlady, Sandra Owens, regards us questioningly. Aren't you the new owners of the cottage up at Skelton Place? She asks, as we hover in the bar area. We've only been in the pub once since moving to Beggar's Nook, and that was for Sunday lunch last month. We'd been impressed with the tasteful pale green Farrow & Ball painted walls, the rustic furniture, and delicious home-cooked food. It had, apparently, undergone a huge makeover when the Owenses took it over 5 years ago. I don't know what to say. Once the news gets out, it will be all over the village. We've run into a bit of bother with our build, says Tom, pleasantly but non-committally. So thought it best to move out for a few nights, just until it's sorted. Right, Sandra says, although she doesn't look particularly convinced. She's in her late 50s and attractive with her highlighted bob and elegant wrap dress. It won't be long before she finds out the truth. But neither of us wants to tell her about it tonight. Fatigue has set in, and it's not even 7 o'clock yet. Still light. I just want to crawl into bed. She shows us to a double room, which is small and cozy, with views of the woods from the back window. Breakfast is between 7:30 and 10, she says, before leaving. Tom is standing by the tea-making facilities, looking out of the window at the trees in the distance. I can't believe this, he says, his back to me. I stretch out on the bed. It's a beautiful four-poster with a quilted bedspread in inky tones. Normally, this would be such a treat for us. We haven't had a holiday for ages. All our money over the last 5 months has been put aside for the extension. But it's tainted, overshadowed by the excavation back at the cottage. Every time I think of it, I feel sick. Snowy hops onto the bed next to me, laying his head on my lap and looking up at me with his soulful brown eyes. I can't believe we've been turfed out of our own house, I say, as I stroke Snowy's head. Then I pull my cardigan around myself. It's turned chilly. Or perhaps it's the shock. Tom flicks the switch on the little plastic kettle, then comes to join us on the bed. The mattress is softer than ours at home. I know, but it will all be okay, he says, with a return to his former optimism. We'll be able to resume our building work soon, and everything will be back to normal. I snuggle into him, wishing I could believe him. We resist the urge to walk past the cottage. Instead, we spend the weekend either in the pub or on long walks through the village and woods. At least it gives me the weekend off decorating, says Tom on Saturday, taking my hand as we amble through the village square. He's done so much to the cottage already since we moved in, taking up the threadbare carpet on the stairs, painting the living room and our bedroom a dove grey, sanding the floorboards. Next, he wants to strip the wallpaper in the little bedroom, ready to decorate before the baby arrives, although he put off doing this until my 12-week scan, so as not to tempt fate. When we eventually return on Sunday after lunch, with our bags at our feet, like visitors in our own home, my heart sinks. There are police cars and vans still parked on our driveway. Another uniformed officer, a middle-aged guy this time, informs us that they should be done excavating by the end of the day, and we're allowed in the cottage, but not the garden, until they've finished. I wonder if they've searched inside. The thought makes me uneasy. I hate to think of the police rifling through our things. When I voice this to Tom, he assures me that they would have said if they were going to do that. Tom and I spend the rest of the afternoon hiding in the living room. What must the neighbours be thinking? I say, standing at the window and sipping a decaf tea. I think of elderly Jack and Brenda next door. A hedge obscures their property from ours, but she's definitely the curtain twitcher type. And when Clive put in the plans for the kitchen extension, they opposed them. A small crowd has gathered at the end of our driveway, only partly hidden by the police vehicles. I bet they're journalists, says Tom, over my shoulder, his fingers clasping a mug. You might want to ring your dad and get some advice. My dad is the chief reporter on one of the national tabloids. I nod grimly. I feel as exposed as if someone has ripped the roof right off our house. This is a nightmare, I mutter. For once, Tom doesn't offer any assurance. Instead, his face is grave, a muscle throbbing near his jawline as he stares out of the window, sipping his coffee in silence. I ring Dad later to ask his advice.
You don't fancy giving your old dad an exclusive?
He deadpans. I laugh. I don't know anything. It might turn out to be hundreds of years old yet.
Well, if it's not, I should warn you. As soon as the police confirm a crime and have identified the body, you'll be swamped by press.
Should we move out? Although, as I say this, I have no idea where we'd actually go. We can't afford a hotel. I wish Dad lived closer. Or Mum. But she's even further away.
No, don't do that. Just be prepared, that's all. And if you need anything, information or advice, let me know.
I can tell he's in the newsroom by the sound of phones ringing in the background and the general hubbub of conversation and activity. Will you be sending someone down here?
I expect we'll use a press agency for now. But if you're going to talk to the press, remember me, yeah? Seriously, Seth, if you're unsure about anything, whether it's the police or the reporters, then come to me first.
Thanks, Dad, I say, feeling reassured. My dad has always had the ability to make me feel safe. The next morning, the police take down the tent and crime tape, and Tom and I stare in horror at the huge hole left in the garden. It's four times bigger than it was when the builders left it. Tom asks his boss if he can work from home for a few days, and we spend them trying to avoid the smattering of journalists that still hover. And then, on Wednesday, the day Tom returns to work, the police call.
I'm afraid it's not good news,
says the male detective with a gruff voice, whose name I instantly forget. I stiffen, waiting.
Two bodies have been found.
I nearly drop my phone. Two bodies?
I'm afraid so, yes. All the bones were recovered and forensics could determine that one was a male and the other a female. We could also work out the ages of the victims based on the bone formation and maturing. Both victims were between 30 and 45.
I can't speak. Nausea rising.
Unfortunately,
he continues,
the female victim died of blunt trauma to the head. We're still trying to ascertain how the man died. The decomposition of tissues makes this more difficult. With the female skeleton, it was more obvious due to the fracture to the skull.
I squeeze my eyes shut, trying not to imagine it. That's awful. I can barely take it in. Are you sure there aren't any more? I suddenly have visions of the whole garden being dug up to reveal a mass grave and shudder at the thought. Other houses of horrors, as the press luridly describe them, come to mind. 25 Cromwell Street and White House Farm. Will our cottage become as infamous? Will we be stuck here forever, nobody ever wanting to buy it? My heart starts to beat faster, and I swallow, trying to concentrate on what the detective is saying.
We had cadaver dogs at the site. We are confident there are no more bodies.
How long have the bodies been there?
We can't be sure for definite, not yet. The soil in your garden is more alkaline-based, and the conditions, therefore, have preserved some of the clothing and shoes. But we think no earlier than around 1970, and by the decomposition, no later than 1990.
Goosebumps ripple over my skin. Two people were murdered in my house. In my idyllic cottage. Everything suddenly takes on a dark, surreal quality.
And of course, we have to speak to everyone who occupied the house between 1970 and 1990.
He continues.
I'm afraid, being the previous owner of the cottage, we will need to speak to Mrs. Rose Gray.
The room tilts. Rose Gray is my grandmother. Chapter 3. May 2018. I can't stop thinking about the bodies. It's on my mind when I take Snowy for his daily walks around the village, when I'm watching TV with Tom, when I'm working on a project in the tiny room with the 1970s flowered wallpaper at the front of the cottage that I use as an office. It didn't take long for news to get around the village. And even though it's been more than 10 days since the excavation, people are still speculating about it. They won't yet know the latest information about how and when the victims died. But while I was in the corner shop earlier, I heard old Mrs. McNulty gossiping about it to one of her elderly friends, a stooped woman wearing a headscarf and pushing a checked bag on wheels.
"I can't imagine the Turners being responsible," she'd said. "They'd been there years. Mrs. Turner was very mousy." "Although," Mrs. McNulty lowered her voice, her beady eyes flashing with excitement, "wasn't there all that business a few years ago with his nephew and the stolen goods?" "Oh, yes, I remember that. Well, they did leave in a bit of a hurry," said headscarf woman. "When was it now? 2 year ago? And I heard they left the cottage in a bit of a state." She lowered her voice. "Hoarders, apparently. Although they kept the garden nice, Mrs. Turner liked to plant bulbs. And now those youngsters have turned up. I hear they've been given the cottage for free. Inheritance, apparently. It's all right for some."
I could feel my cheeks burning. I put the tin of baked beans back on the shelf and left the shop before they noticed me. Now I grab my cardigan from the back of the chair. It's cooler today, the sun struggling to poke through clouds, and I bend over Snowy's bed to kiss him on the top of his fluffy head. "See you later, mister." I'm knocking off work early today, like I do every Thursday, to visit Gran. I feel a lurch of guilt when I think of how I ended up missing my visit to her last week because of the swarm of press outside our house. Yet today won't be like all the other Thursdays. Today, when I sit opposite my grandmother, I'll be wondering what happened all those years ago. How did two people end up dead and buried in her garden? My battered yellow Converse trainers crunch over the gravelled driveway as I dart to my Mini. I'm wearing denim dungarees with the bottoms turned up. They feel so much more comfortable now my tummy is expanding. I'm 16 weeks pregnant and have a small bump. Although it doesn't look like I'm pregnant. More bloated. I've tied my dark curls back with a matching yellow scrunchie. My mum always turns her nose up at my collection of scrunchies. "They're just so 80s, she says, rolling her eyes. "I can't believe they've made a comeback." I haven't seen her since Christmas, and that hadn't gone very well, thanks to her rude boyfriend, Alberto. The weeks are flying by, and I still haven't told her she's going to be a grandmother. Every time I think about telling her, I imagine her disappointment. As I get behind the wheel, I notice a man standing in the lane, partially concealed by our front wall, staring up at the cottage. He's stocky, with a face like a bulldog, maybe mid to late 50s, wearing jeans and a waxed jacket. When he notices me, he moves away. Was he taking photos of the cottage? He must be another journalist. Most of them have given up for the moment, until there's new information to be had. But every now and again, another will pop up, like the weeds in my front garden. On Saturday, as we made our way down our driveway to take Snowy for a walk, a journalist sprang out in front of us, obscuring our path and taking a photo of us. Tom was furious and swore at him as he scuttled back to his car. I pull out of the driveway and continue slowly past him, making sure to give him enough room so he doesn't have to press himself against the hedge. But as I do, I notice him shooting me such an intense look that it shocks me. From the rearview mirror, I see him getting into a black saloon parked further down the hill, next to number 8. Tom came home from work yesterday, saying he'd spotted a piece about the bodies in the garden in a copy of The Sun that someone had left on the tube. It had a sensationalist heading that played on the skeletons at Skelton Place, accompanied by the photo the journalist took of us on Saturday, with startled looks on our faces.
"Oh, God, Tom,"
I'd said, my face flushed with fear.
"They're going to say we're Wiltshire's answer to Fred and Rosemary West."
He'd laughed properly then.
"No, they won't. It happened at least 30 years ago. We weren't even born."
But my gran was. I pushed the thought of the man from my mind as I continue down the hill, passing the stag and pheasant at the bottom. Instead, I think again about how peaceful Beggar's Nook is, with its beautiful old Cotswold stone buildings. I drive through the village square, taking in the market cross, the pretty church, the corner shop, a cafe, and the one boutique selling trinkets, cards, and slouchy, expensive clothes. All walkable from the cottage and in a dip, surrounded by the woods and the thick oak trees that stretch up to the sky. It gives the impression that the village is hidden from the rest of the world. I cross the bridge and continue down the long, winding lane, pretty stone houses either side, until I get to the farm at the end, so different from built-up Croydon, so safe. Or so I thought. Now I'm not so sure. The murders must have happened before Gran bought the cottage back in the 1970s. I know she went on to rent it out for decades after she moved to Bristol. We found out this detail only recently, after she went into a care home. Mum and I had been a little surprised. As far as we'd been aware, Gran had only ever owned one property, her red brick terrace in the Bishopston area of Bristol, where Mum grew up, and where I spent every summer. Gran, who, before the dementia took over, loved to bake and tend her plants, was calm and practical, never raising her voice. Not like Mum, who has a short fuse and no filter, although she's mellowed a bit now. Those summers with Gran, in her Bristol house with the large garden and adjoining allotment at the end, were my sanctuary, a break from my mum and the drama that always seemed to surround her. I'd loved Gran's fat black Labrador with the grey whiskers, Bruce. Mum never wanted us to get a pet. Too smelly, she said, but Gran's house never smelt. And the old-fashioned comfy sofas with white cotton slips on the arms that Gran would wash and starch every week. The butterscotch sweets she had in a tin at the top of the cupboard. And the garden with a wired fence that separated it from her neighbours. The warm, musty smell of the greenhouse and the tomato plants inside. It was comforting to see Gran in the greenhouse tending those plants, talking to them softly to encourage them to grow. I love my mum dearly, but she was, and still is, so high energy, so effusive and demonstrative with her colourful clothes and over-the-top personality, that she sometimes makes me feel exhausted. I've always felt more of an affinity with Gran, both of us loving nature and the outdoors, slightly reclusive, preferring our own company to crowds of people. Gran made me feel normal when I admitted I'd rather stay in and watch EastEnders than go out and play with the other kids in the street, and that it was okay not to have to be out there and loud all the time. My mother was always telling me when I was a kid that I was too quiet and too shy, and asking, "Why don't you go and mix with the other girls in your year instead of just sticking with one friend?" But Mum is a social butterfly, fluttering from one group of friends to another with an ease I have always envied, even if I don't want it for myself. As a result, I felt awkward and uninteresting growing up, never knowing what to say. Until I met Tom at university. Tom made me feel I could be myself, and I realized that, with him, I was capable of being witty and fun. The traffic builds up as I head towards Bristol. The care home Gran lives in is off a dual carriageway in a town called Filton. It was nearly a year ago when I started to realize something was very wrong with her. It started off innocuously enough. Gran was always a little forgetful, forever saying, "Here, have you seen my bag?" Or, "Where'd I put my glasses?" in the Cockney accent she'd never lost, despite leaving London in her 20s. She was always so independent and practical. Even up until last year, she was strong and able-bodied enough to get on a train to visit me in Croydon, following a map. She had an old-fashioned mobile phone and an A to Z that was dog-eared and always in her handbag. Her little Westie, Snowy, in tow. She refused to let me or Tom pick her up at the station, despite us constantly offering. The first sign was the two birthday cards she sent me, only a few days after the other, as though she'd forgotten about sending the first. Then, when she came to stay with us a few months later, she'd seemed more forgetful. Snowy's name slipped easily from her mind, and she forgot to walk or feed him until I had to remind her or did it myself. And then, after she'd been staying with us a few days, she turned to me and Tom one evening while we were watching TV and said, "Here, where have the other couple gone?" It had sent a shiver of fear down my spine. Because there was no other couple. Gran had been sitting with us all evening. And it broke my heart to realize that, at times, Gran had no idea who Tom or I was. Her memory fading in and out, like the radio with a bad signal. On that visit, it was obvious that Gran was finding it hard looking after Snowy. So when I offered to keep him with me, she agreed. I'd cried behind my sunglasses as I watched Gran get on the train without her beloved dog, pulling her wheelie suitcase. And I didn't stop worrying until she rang later to say she was home safely. But just 3 days afterwards, Gran called me in a panic to say she'd lost the dog, and I had to remind her gently that Snowy was living with me and Tom now. The final thing that really did it, that made me ring Mum and tell her everything, was when one of Gran's neighbours, Esme, contacted me.
"It's your Gran, lovely," she'd said. "She left a pan on to boil dry. It was lucky I popped over. She could have burnt the house down."
When I confessed my concerns to Mum, she flew back from Spain and whisked Gran off to the doctor. After that, things happened quickly. But Mum always got things done. She was just that kind of decisive person. And a private nursing facility was found for Gran, not far from where she'd lived in the Bristol house with the allotment that I will always think of as home. I pull into the spacious car park outside the front of the huge, grey, gothic-looking building called Elmsbrook, which makes it sound more like a retreat than a care home. Although Mum said it used to be an asylum with bars at the window. But it was nice, Elmsbrook, It was mid-range, price-wise, although Gran still had to sell the house to pay for it. I swallow a lump in my throat when I remember how I'd felt packing up her things and clearing out her home. It was in one of my grandmother's more lucid moments, last November, when she told me and Mum about the cottage. This was the first time we even knew of its existence. "It's in your name, Lorna," Gran had whispered, leaning forwards in her high-backed chair and holding onto Mum's hand. "I transferred the deeds 10 years ago." And I had marvelled at Gran's astuteness. By putting the cottage in my Mum's name, it wouldn't have to be sold to pay for Gran's care. Afterwards, as Mum and I stood outside the care home saying goodbye, Mum, shivering in her bright orange coat, had turned to me and said, "I always knew my mother was a wily thing, squirreling her money away. She would have bought that cottage as an investment." She blew on her hands. "Anyway, I don't want it. It's yours if you'd like it. I know you hate living in the city." And it had shocked me because, for once, I felt my mother really understood me. "But you haven't even seen it," I'd protested. "What do I want with a cottage in the middle of nowhere?" And I could see her point. A cottage in the countryside would be too mundane for Mum. No, she needed sunshine and sangria and exotic men who weren't much older than me. Mum had flown back to San Sebastian without even visiting the cottage. She couldn't have been less interested in it, which helped ease my guilt for accepting the offer. A free house. No mortgage. It meant the sort of financial freedom Tom and I had never expected in a million years, especially not in our mid-twenties. It meant I could give up my job in Croydon and go freelance, surrounded by idyllic countryside. A dream come true. But now I revisit that conversation. 10 years ago, Gran had transferred the deeds into my mother's name. Why? Was it purely for financial reasons, to avoid inheritance tax? Or because she knew a murder had taken place? But no, that's ridiculous. There's no way Gran would have any knowledge of this. I know it like I know I love black coffee and peanut butter sandwiches and the velvety patches of fur on Snowy's ears and the smell of cut grass. I take a deep breath and hold on to the steering wheel as though to steady myself. I can never predict when I visit which Gran I'll get. Sometimes she'll recognize me. At others, she acts like I'm one of the staff. And each time, it's like losing her all over again. As I get out of the car, I notice a black saloon slowing down on the road so that it idles past me. I can't be sure, but it looks like the same car that was parked near the cottage earlier. The driver's face is turned towards me as it coasts past. It's a man, but I can't make out his features. Is it the same guy as earlier? Is he going to pull into the car park too? Then the car speeds up and drives off down the road. I stand for a moment staring after it, wondering if I'm worrying about nothing, or if this is something to be concerned about. Chapter 4. Gran is sitting in the day room by the bay window that overlooks the manicured grounds, a coffee table in front of her and an empty chair opposite. The sun has come out, and it streams through the net curtains, highlighting dust motes that dance around her head, like little orbs. My heart contracts with such love that my eyes smart. Seeing her here makes me ache with longing to go back in time to how it used to be. Gran bustling around her little kitchen, making endless cups of tea the colour of treacle. Or in the greenhouse, showing my teenage self how to plant radishes. Gran's head is bent. She's lost the plumpness to her face, the skin now hanging loose around her jowls, her cheekbones prominent. Her snow-white hair, it once used to be a beautiful coppery red, from a bottle, Gran always claimed, is fluffy, the texture of cotton wool. She's pushing the pieces of a jigsaw around the table, and, for a moment, it takes me back to when I was a kid, and we'd sit together in companionable silence in the evenings, as the sun went down, trying to work out the best way to construct the puzzle. I stand in the doorway for a few minutes, just watching. The room is too warm and smells musty, like roast dinners and overboiled veg. The carpet is the kind you'd find in an old-fashioned seaside guesthouse, all red and gold swirls.
Rose is having a good day, says a voice from behind me.
It's Millie, one of the carers, and my favourite. Millie is a few years younger than me, with the kindest face and widest smile I've ever seen. She has short, spiky black hair and piercings halfway up both ears.
Oh, I'm so pleased. I've some news for her.
Millie raises an eyebrow.
Ooh, good, I hope.
I touch my stomach self-consciously and nod. I don't want to think of the other thing. The bad news. The bodies. Millie squeezes my shoulder encouragingly, then moves on to help an elderly man who's trying to get out of his chair. I make my way to the end of the room, weaving past some of the other residents clustered around the television, and the old man reading a newspaper upside down in the corner, until I reach Gran. She looks up as I approach and, for a moment, confusion flits across her features, and I have to swallow my disappointment. She doesn't recognize me. Today is not a good day, after all. I slide into the chair opposite. It has such a high back that I feel like I'm sitting on a throne.
Hi, Granny.
It's me, Safi. Gran doesn't speak for a few seconds, continuing to move around the pieces of the jigsaw, even though she hasn't started making the picture. The box is propped up at the end of the table. A black Labrador puppy on the front, surrounded by flowers.
Let's find the edges first, she always used to say,
her weathered hands, the result of many hours gardening, nimbly seeking out the right pieces. But now there is no method. Gran instead just moving the pieces around aimlessly, her fingers gnarled and wrinkly.
Safi, Safi,
she mumbles, not looking at me. And then her head shoots up and her eyes sparkle with recognition.
Safi, it's you. You've come to see me. Where have you been?
Her whole face lights up, and I reach out and touch her frail hand. She's 75, but since she was admitted into the home, she's looked much older. I know I haven't got long before Gran's mind slips back in time. It never ceases to amaze me how much she remembers about the past, but can't recall something as recent as what she had for breakfast.
I'm pregnant, Granny. I'm going to have a baby, I say, unable to keep the joy and fear out of my voice.
A baby, so wonderful, such a gift.
She clutches my hands a little too tightly.
You lucky girl.
Her eyes cloud, and I can tell she's having trouble assessing her memories.
Is Tim happy?
Tom. And yes, he's over the moon. Gran had doted on Tom before the dementia diagnosis. She couldn't do enough for him whenever she saw him. She used to send him little care packages, a homemade cake, some sloe gin she'd brewed herself, rhubarb she'd grown in the garden because she knew he loved it, and I didn't.
You need to feed him up,
she used to tell me. It was a generation thing, I would remind myself, to keep your man happy. Not that I remembered Gran ever having a man. My granddad died before Mum was even born. Gran's face darkens.
Victor wasn't happy. Oh no, he wasn't happy at all.
Victor? I'd never heard her mention a Victor before. She told me my granddad had been called William. Not that she ever spoke about him. Even Mum didn't know much. But I don't want to interrupt Gran's flow by asking questions. So I stay silent.
He wanted to hurt the baby,
she says, her face crumpling. Well, Tom would never do anything to hurt the baby. Tom is a nice man. You love Tom, remember? Her expression changes again.
Oh, yes. Tom is lovely. Tom likes his fried breakfasts.
I smile. Gran always made Tom a full English every time we stayed. That's right. How am I going to bring up the subject of the remains of two dead people in the garden? Should I even bring it up? Maybe it's best to leave it for now. But then I think of the police, who will need to interview her at some point, knowing she owned the cottage for so many years, even if she did have tenants. If I've already told her about it, it will be less of a shock when the police speak to her. And we love living in Skelton Place, I begin tentatively. Her face clouds over.
Skelton Place.
The cottage, Gran. Beggar's Nook?
You're living in the cottage at Skelton Place?
Yes. Mum wanted to stay in Spain. You know what she's like. She loves the sun. So Tom and I are living there. And it's so generous of you. I've told her all this before, of course. Gran starts moving the pieces of the puzzle around aimlessly again, and I'm afraid I've lost her. I have to say something now, quickly, before she retreats back into herself. And the weird thing is, we started digging up the garden to build an extension, and we found two bodies. Gran's head shoots up.
Bodies?
Yes, Gran. Buried in the garden.
Dead bodies?
Yes. Is there any other kind?
At Skelton Place?
I nod encouragingly. A woman and a man. Gran stares at me for such a long time that I'm afraid she's gone into some sort of catatonic state. But then her eyes mist over, as though she's remembering. She suddenly grabs hold of my hands again, disrupting the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle so that some of them fall to the floor.
Is it Sheila?
She whispers.
Sheila?
Who's Sheila, Gran? Gran snatches her hands away, a film of confusion over her eyes, like cataracts. She looks like a frightened child as she shrinks further into her seat.
Such a wicked little girl. That's what they all said. A wicked little girl.
Who? Who's a wicked little girl?
That's what they all said.
I need to change the subject. Gran is getting agitated. I lean over and pick up the pieces of jigsaw from the carpet, The gardens here are lovely, I say, when I straighten up, looking past Gran and out of the window. Are you still able to get out there every day? Gran's mind might be going, but there is nothing wrong with her physically. But Gran is still mumbling about Sheila and a wicked little girl. I reach across the table and take Gran's gnarled hand tightly between mine. Gran, who is Sheila? Gran stops her mumbling and looks directly at me, her eyes focusing. I don't know. The police will want to talk to you at some point, but only because you owned the cottage and... A flash of panic flits across Gran's face. The police? She looks wildly about her, as though expecting them to be behind her. It's okay. They'll only want to ask you a few questions, nothing to worry about. It will only be a procedure, something to tick off their list. Is it Lorna? Is Lorna dead? I swallow my guilt. No, Gran. Mum is in Spain, remember? Wicked little girl. I release Gran's hand gently and sit back in my chair. Gran is mumbling to herself again. I'm not going to get anything more from her today. I should never have mentioned the bodies. It was unfair. Of course she's not going to know anything about them. Why would she? Instead, I reach over and help Gran with the jigsaw in companionable silence, just like we used to do when I was a kid. Edges first.
Chapter 5. Theo. Theo pulls up onto the driveway, parking his old Volvo next to his father's black Mercedes, which looks like a hearse. The old, rambling house looms over him like something from a horror film, eclipsing the sun and causing him to shiver. He hates the place. Always has done. His friends thought it was impressive when they visited, which was rarely. He tried to keep them away as much as possible. But the depressing grey stone and the ugly gargoyles that peer down from the roof as if they're about to swoop still give him the creeps. The house is much too big for an elderly man living by himself. Theo doesn't understand why his dad refuses to sell it. He doubts he holds on to it for sentimental reasons. A status symbol, he imagines. Theo has never felt the need to show off about what he's got. Not that he's got much in the material sense, but that's not how he measures his self-worth anyway. Another thing his dad doesn't understand. He lets himself into the cavernous hallway, with the wood panelling and the winding staircase that he has hated with a passion since his mother's death, and the deer heads on the wall. Those heads gave him nightmares as a kid. He breathes in the familiar smell of wood smoke and floor polish. His dad has a housekeeper, Mavis, who comes in every few days to do the cleaning and his washing, but she's not due until tomorrow. Dad, it's Theo, he calls. There's no answer, so he darts upstairs to the study, which is at the front of the house. The rubber soles of his trainers squeaking against the polished floor. His father spends a lot of time in his study, doing what Theo can only imagine. He's been retired for years. He opens the study door and he can tell instantly his dad is in one of his moods, anger seeping off of him. His large face with the familiar flat nose that Theo has inherited is redder than usual. Even the bald spot on the top of his head is pink, poking through the remains of his wispy white hair. When he acts like this, Theo thinks his dad is a prick. He actually thinks his dad is a prick most of the time, even when he's not behaving like a spoilt child, rather than the 76-year-old retired consultant that he really is. He wonders what set him off now. It doesn't take much. Mavis has probably put one of his golfing trophies back in the wrong place. Theo is grateful he doesn't have to live with him anymore. Theo has only popped over to check on him, like he does every week, because even though his dad hasn't been the best father or the best husband, he feels a sense of duty. And he knows it's what his mum would have wanted. Theo is the only family his dad has left. And sometimes, when his dad forgets to act like a total dickhead in his more vulnerable moments, like when they sit side by side watching a film together on the sofa and he falls asleep, his face looking peaceful and old, with his chin resting on his chest. He feels a rush of fondness towards him. And then his dad will wake up and turn back into his grumpy, demanding self, and the sympathy Theo had been feeling just moments before evaporates. Despite all this, Theo tries to cut his dad some slack. He understands that losing his wife, Theo's mum, 14 years ago was devastating. Caroline Carmichael had been only 45 when she died, and so vibrant, so caring. Her loss left a gaping hole in their lives. Not that his father would admit to any feelings. Showing vulnerability is a weakness, according to him. He prefers to hide his emotions behind his gruff exterior. Despite this, Theo has always felt a grudging respect for him. He's a brilliant man, exceptionally clever and hugely talented in his field. Even now, after retiring, he still writes papers for medical publications. Theo clears his throat. His dad is so busy slamming drawers and opening and shutting cabinet doors that he doesn't hear him at first. Theo has to repeat the action several times before his dad looks up. "What do you want?" "Charming," thinks Theo. He's had a bastard of a day, helping his brother-in-law Simon move house, and he's on a late shift at the restaurant tonight. It's not a fancy enough restaurant to impress his dad, even if it is on one of Harrogate's premier streets. But still, he enjoys working there as head chef. He feels grubby after hauling the furniture from the van and needs a shower before starting work at 6 p.m. "Just thought I'd look in. Make sure you're eating properly. I've made a couple of lasagnas for you to freeze." He holds up the carrier bag to illustrate his point. His dad grunts in response before turning his back on Theo and continues rifling through a drawer. Theo runs a hand across his chin. God, he needs a shave. Jen hates it when he has stubble. Says it scratches her face when he kisses her. He steps further into the room. "Can I help?" "No." "Okay, right. Well, I'll dump these in the freezer and then I'll be off. I'm working tonight." His dad doesn't say anything. His body a question mark as he bends over a drawer. Theo can see the outline of his shoulder blades through his polo shirt. He always dresses smartly. That's one thing Theo can be grateful for. He showers every day, splashes on the same Prada aftershave he's used for years, and dresses in his favourite uniform of chinos and a smart Ralph Lauren top, with a V-neck cable knit jumper if it's cold. If his father ever let himself go, he would begin to worry. "Make sure you eat the lasagna. Keep your strength up. You fuss too much, like your mother used to." He has an image of his lovely mum, running herself ragged in a fruitless attempt at keeping his dad happy. There had been an 18-year age difference between his parents. Friends at school had thought his dad was his grandfather. It used to embarrass Theo, although he probably wouldn't have minded if his dad had acted like a kindly grandfather. Nevertheless, his friends had been impressed when his dad occasionally picked him up from school in his expensive car. Just as he's about to leave the room, his dad stands up, brushing down his chinos. He's tall, even taller than Theo, with the same long limbs and rangy physique. Theo has to concede his dad is still handsome and fit for his age, from regularly playing golf at the club. "I'm going to look downstairs," he says, brushing past Theo. He doesn't say what he's looking for. "He's staying for a cup of tea." Fuck. Now Theo is going to feel obliged. "A quick one. I've got work tonight." "Yes, you've said." His father had wanted him to go to medical school, following the family size 11 footsteps. He thinks Theo's job as a chef is little more than a hobby. It still riles Theo when he thinks about it, so he tries not to. "I'll go and put the kettle on," promises Theo. But his father doesn't reply, slamming out of the door, the soles of his brogues clipping on the lacquered parquet. Just as Theo is about to leave the room, something catches his eye on his dad's desk. It's immaculate, as everything in the study always is, even after all the rummaging. But left on the padded, dark green leather insert is a newspaper clipping. Theo wonders if it's anything to do with his mother. His dad has obsessively kept everything that ever mentioned her name, while simultaneously never wanting to talk about her death. He goes to it and picks it up, confused when he sees it isn't about his mother at all. It's dated last week and is a small article. Only a few paragraphs long, accompanied by a photograph about a young couple from a Cotswold village in Wiltshire who found two bodies in their back garden. Skeleton Place, screams the headline. The names of the couple are underlined in red, as well as another, Rose Gray. Underneath the article, someone has written, "Find her."